Picture two nations in 1900, both blessed with fertile lands, ambitious immigrants, and boundless optimism. One becomes history's most successful economy. The other collapses into corruption and poverty. This isn't a tale of destiny or geography. It's a story of choices. Argentina and the United States once looked remarkably similar. Young countries with vast frontiers, agricultural abundance, and European immigrants flooding in by the millions. Argentina ranked among the world's 10 wealthiest economies. A century later, the gap between them had become a chasm. What happened? The answer dismantles a comforting myth that some countries were simply meant to succeed while others were doomed to fail. Our economic futures aren't carved in stone. They're shaped by human decisions, often made by small groups pursuing their own interests, that compound over decades into dramatically different national trajectories. This is the central insight that makes this exploration essential reading, not because it offers easy answers, but because it reveals how profoundly our collective choices matter. Both Argentina and America faced the same challenge, distributing vast, fertile territories. Their choices created entirely different societies. America's Homestead Act of 1862 offered 160 acres to settlers willing to improve the land, creating millions of independent family farmers, literate, skilled immigrants from Northern Europe who embraced citizenship and the American dream. These weren't just workers, they were stakeholders with political voice and economic independence. Argentina took the opposite path. The government sold massive plots to wealthy investors and military officers, creating an aristocratic landowning class. While America attracted skilled workers who became citizens, Argentina's immigrants were often seasonal laborers who returned to Europe after harvests. By 1930, only 5% had become citizens. The elite viewed manufacturing as vulgar, preferring conspicuous consumption to industrial investment. When the Depression hit, America emerged as an industrial creditor nation, maintaining democracy. Argentina, dependent on agricultural exports and foreign capital, turned to authoritarianism. Juan Perón's 1946 rise seemed promising through import substitution, building domestic industries behind high tariff walls. But unlike American companies who knew protection was temporary, Argentine companies knew they'd never face international competition. The result? Expensive, unreliable products. Cars cost twice as much. Appliances broke constantly. Political connections mattered more than competitiveness. Growing at just 2% annually per capita, Argentina fell catastrophically behind. Once twice as rich as Spain in 1950, by 1975, the average Spaniard had surpassed the average Argentine. The compound effect of policy choices that created a cronyish economy where the politically connected thrived while ordinary citizens paid inflated prices. Rome and Washington, D.C. represent opposite approaches to capital cities. Ancient Rome swelled to 1 million inhabitants between 130 to 50 BC, twice any previous city's size. This growth stemmed from political expedience, not economic vitality. Authorities extended grain handouts to 320,000 Italian citizens to prevent rebellion, creating a parasitic metropolis placated with bread and circuses funded by taxing conquered provinces. Washington was deliberately designed as a small federal district, its residents lacking even voting representation, a choice meant to prevent disproportionate political power. Medieval Venice and Florence thrived through commerce rather than conquest. Venice became Europe's third largest city by providing finance and commercial services, pioneering bills of exchange and trade credit. Today's urbanization happens at unprecedented speed. Seoul grew from 1 to 8 million people in 25 years, a transformation that took London 130 years. China manages migration through deliberate policy, while India's uncontrolled rural refugees flood Mumbai, creating massive slums. The worst imbalances occur when governments favor industry over agriculture, essentially pushing people out rather than pulling them toward opportunity. Egypt was once the Mediterranean's breadbasket. Today, it imports half its staple food. This paradox reveals virtual water, the water embedded in traded goods. Producing Egypt's imported wheat domestically would require 1/6 of the Aswan Dam's entire reservoir. Yet Middle Eastern countries still export water-intensive crops, focusing on high-value products. Vegetables generate 50 cents per cubic meter of water versus 8 cents for wheat. Australia bizarrely became the world's largest net exporter of virtual water because its water trading system restricts farmers from selling water rights to cities. Trade transforms scarcity into abundance through specialization. In Steinbeck's The Pearl, a fisherman's discovery brings ruin instead of prosperity, mirroring many resource-rich nations. Despite massive 1970s oil wealth, exporters like Saudi Arabia remained poorer than former communist countries by 2000. Zambia nationalized copper mines in 1970, squandering proceeds and neglecting maintenance. When prices soared in 2006, foreign companies owned the mines with generous tax holidays. Profits flowed abroad while the strengthening kwacha devastated other exports. Resources fuel violence by funding rebels outside government control. Angola's Jonas Savimbi maintained a rebel state for 20 years through diamond sales. Mining regions suffer rampant prostitution and HIV/AIDS. Success requires preventing economic distortion and protecting revenue. Norway and Chile maintain stabilization funds in foreign currencies, releasing money according to long-term projections. Botswana transformed from having just 12 kilometers of paved road in 1965 into the world's fastest-growing economy. President Seretse Khama created a national fund for diamond wealth, mined slowly to match spending capacity, selecting projects strictly on economic returns. The difference between Botswana and Zambia wasn't the resource, it was management. Indonesia under Suharto reached $3,000 per capita income despite rampant corruption, while Tanzania remained poor under honest leadership at less than $1,000. Suharto imposed order while adopting sound economic policies. Foreign companies paid for protection through connected individuals, creating an organized network that addressed investor concerns. His favorite companies were export-oriented, exposing them to market discipline. Tanzania's honest leader Nyerere presents a stark contrast. His Ujamaa philosophy led to harmful policies, trade barriers, price controls, and failing state companies. Agricultural marketing boards paid farmers just 4% of world prices. Though Suharto's son profited from the clove monopoly, Indonesia remained the world's largest producer. Suharto's corruption extracted wealth without destroying production. Tanzania's corruption eliminated production itself. Efficient corruption requires central coordination. When bribe-taking agencies coordinate, they maintain lower rates, allowing businesses to flourish. Suharto deflected reform demands by providing growth until the 1997 Asian financial crisis exposed his system's fragility. The lesson: well-intentioned policies without competent execution can be worse than cynical policies executed effectively. Development requires both integrity and competence. Lacking either creates failure. Giant pandas exemplify evolutionary dead ends, subsisting on nutrient-poor bamboo, requiring 16 hours of daily feeding, the equivalent of trying to subsist on sugar-coated cardboard. Despite their herbivorous diet, they retain a carnivore's short digestive tract, causing most nutrients to pass through undigested. They've gone down a developmental path they cannot reverse. Similarly, the QWERTY keyboard persists despite more efficient alternatives due to network effects and inertia. Russia's path dependence runs deeper. Since medieval times, Russia has featured a dominant executive with minimal checks and balances. When Tsarism collapsed in 1917, autocratic power transferred to communists. When communism collapsed in the 1990s, Central and Eastern European nations with pre-communist market experience recovered quickly. Russia eventually returned under Putin to centralized power, press muzzled, NGOs hamstrung, regional governors controlled. China prioritized economic reform while maintaining political control, with local party officials competing to increase regional growth. India theoretically should outperform China, given its British-inherited civil service and democratic system. Yet India remains substantially poorer with slower growth. The caste system, intensified under British rule, created a zero-sum society ideal for clientelist politics based on vote banks of caste, religion, or ethnicity. Path dependence isn't destiny. The Asian tiger's sudden growth and China's post-1979 boom weren't gradual cultural shifts. They were deliberate policy choices that shattered previous patterns. Countries get stuck on wrong paths, but crises open narrow windows for dramatic course correction. Following the right principles is exhausting. Politicians must overcome entrenched interests and bring public opinion along, yet it's possible. Nations that have risen can fall through mistakes. Argentina could have mirrored America, and America could end up like Argentina. Our economic futures remain unwritten, shaped by today's choices about land distribution, trade policy, resource management, corruption, and institutional design. History should inspire hope and action, not resignation.